The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times and the News and Observer. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we will be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And to begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, let's allow our imaginations to wonder for a moment, not wander, but wonder. What if you could travel for an entire year? That's right. Travel anywhere in the world to as many places as time and distance might permit. Well, the only catch, allow time to write about and share your experiences along the way. Well, that's the journey Jada Ewan will share with us today in her article, One Woman, 12 Months, 52 Places. It's from the January 4th, 2019 issue of the New York Times. And the editors preface the article with these words: "It was a dream job, visiting the globe's most alluring destinations on assignment. Here's what our 2018 traveler learned in a year of almost nonstop travel." The man on the train platform, who spoke only Hindi, looked at my ticket and chuckled. This had been one of those days when mistakes piled up faster than I could track them. I had tarried too long in Chandigarh, India, and the four-hour taxi ride back to New Delhi now promised to be a six-hour slog in traffic. No problem. I could take a train instead, I thought, only to run out of money on my cell phone SIM card just as I was booking a last-minute ticket. I hopped in a tuk-tuk and raced to the station and got there 5 minutes after the last fast train had left for the night. When I started this harebrained experiment in January, and that would have been January of 2018, to visit and report on the Times' entire 52 places to go in 2018 list, I thought that by stop 48, for sure, I'd be the Wonder Woman of travel, blocking mishaps with a flick of my wrist. Instead, I was staring down a 2 a.m. arrival in New Delhi before having to force myself awake for a morning plane to Bhutan. But there was the man on the platform, a waiter for the railway, whose job it is to pass out dinners, flashing a gesture that seemed to mean, "Don't worry, I've got you." I had bought an unreserved ticket, which I thought was for people who'd had trouble purchasing online, but which really meant I'd likely have to stand for 5 hours. But when the train pulled in, the man talked to the conductor and ushered me into a sleeper car. English speakers all around jumped in to interpret. $7 in fines and upgrade fees later, I was sitting in a cluster of bunks with four boisterous 20-something women from New Delhi. The words dream job come up whenever I tell people about these 52 Places project. Like the thousands of others who answered that fateful job listing, travel the world for the New York Times, I had a vision of winning a journalism lottery, of getting to leave behind my routine to swim in waterfalls in Australia, paraglide off mountaintops in Switzerland, and eat at Michelin-starred restaurants in France. And I got to do all of those things, for which I am incredibly grateful. I've also had to face reality, that constant travel alone on an illogical route no sane human would plan might take a toll on my physical and mental well-being, that the Times quite reasonably expected me to do work and file stories, which meant spending a lot of time in beautiful destinations in front of a computer, that I'd make gaffes along the way and have to weather the sting of valid criticism, that I'd meet new friends only to have to say goodbye a few days later, and that I'd be mostly celibate, miss the births of four close friends' babies, forget to call my parents, that I'd reach the end, and all I'd want is to do it over again. I started out, arms laden with recommendations and highlights, determined to do every one of them, eat all the food in New Orleans, hike to the sea cave everyone goes to in Tasmania, visit every mountain temple in Pyeongchang, South Korea. Yet what I remember most are the small wins and human connections. The kind people and delicious sachapapas, the deconstructed hot dogs with French fries at a Peruvian food truck on the highway outside Disney Springs, Florida. The man in Lucerne, Switzerland, who returned my laptop when I left it on a bridge in the train. That army of concerned citizens in Chandigarh. Trust has been the through line that has emerged from it all. Trust in myself, trust in the fundamental goodness of people, trust that as a solo female traveler, I could watch my back without walling myself off from experiences. You see, it was a dream job. It's just that my idea of what made this dream job dreamy has changed so much. And she now goes on and shares with us some lessons from her 12-month travel-thon. Lesson number one, a year is short. I was going on 40, feeling sad about being single and contemplating a sabbatical from New York Magazine, where I'd worked for 17 years, when I clicked on the New York Times homepage and saw something curious, a job listing in the most read articles list. Did I want to travel around the world and document it? I asked. Sure I did. So did pretty much everyone. By the time I saw the listing, 3,500 people had already applied. The final number, they tell me, was 13,000. The odds were so impossible and the selection process so mysterious that I couldn't allow myself to get too excited. And then I got the incredible phone call telling me I had 3 weeks to pack up my apartment, say goodbye to everyone I knew, quit a workplace that I felt like family, and set out for a year on the road. All through my 20s and 30s, I had watched friends move to London or West Africa or quit their jobs and travel and wondered how they possibly had the confidence to do it. I had made the huge, scary leap from New Mexico to New York City after college because it was one of the big city I knew and I had family there. And then I stayed at the same workplace, building a career I loved, while living in a series of closet-sized walk-ups and earning barely enough money to go home for the holidays. Why do you think they picked you? Interviewers often ask me, and I didn't know the answer. I suspected it was because I hadn't done anything like this before. I'd never been brave enough, and maybe I could be a representative for those who didn't think they were brave enough either. Getting on that first plane to New Orleans, I felt as though I were stepping into an unknowable void from which there was no return. The first few months were tough. 5 stops in and behind on my writing, I wound up in Bogota, Colombia, still needing to file my articles on Montgomery, Alabama, which was stop number 3, and Disney Springs, Florida, stop number 4. I spent 3 straight days in my Bogota hotel, losing precious time to report on and photograph the city. The one day I got outside, I took a taxi 30 minutes to the museum I wanted to see and realized I'd left my wallet back at the hotel. And I just lost it. I called a dear friend of mine who works for the Wall Street Journal and has made many a global move and sobbed. I know this feels daunting right now, she said, but you have to remember that a year is short. I argued that this was the longest year of my life, and it was only February, and she didn't know what she was talking about. But the saying stuck in my head and acquired new meaning whenever I hear myself complain about this wondrous opportunity. Freezing down to your bones and sleeping in a by-the-hour motel where you shower while sitting on the toilet? Suck it up. You're about to see the rainbow hills of Shangji, China. A year is short. Freezing again and dinner is bar nuts because you waited past 8 p.m. when all the restaurants close. You just rode a horse in Iceland. A year is short. A car got towed in Auckland, New Zealand while on your third trip to the Chinese consulate trying to get a visa. But you're in New Zealand and you're going to China. A year is short. A year is short and a year is not enough. A year is short and I was strong and the risk had always been worth it. Now lesson number 2, know thy logistical self. My 27-hour travel day from Kanazawa, Japan to India was one of the trickiest of the year, and I had gamed it out to the minute. A 4 a.m. taxi to Kanazawa Station, where I'd picked up luggage I'd left in a locker. 6-hour train ride with 2 transfers arriving in the Osaka airport with a generous 2.5 hours to check in for my flight. I'd filled out the longest form in the world to get my India e-visa and paid to get it expedited. And I had a ticket for onward travel to Bhutan, having anticipating that India would require me to show I'd booked travel to exit the country before I could get on the plane to Japan. Then the Air Asia ticket counter woman asked if I had a paper copy of my e-visa. I hadn't thought to print it out. Nowhere else in the world in 47 stops had I needed to show anything but my phone at a check-in counter. So she couldn't let me on the flight without it, she said. Check-in was closing in 20 minutes. After a mad scramble, I ended up in line at a Family Mart convenience store behind a woman printing out what looked like a 40-page dissertation, watching as the clock ticked down. The complicated printer setup required downloading an app on my phone, and by the time I had printed it out, I'd missed the deadline by 15 minutes. I raced up two flights of escalators and down several long corridors carrying the bags. I hadn't been allowed to check, prepared to beg the ticket agent for leniency. By some miracle, the line was still open. I handed everything over, smiling with relief, and then looked up to see my plane was on a 2-hour delay. So, like any reasonable person, I went back to the Family Mart and bought a basket full of sushi snacks and tea-flavored Kit Kats, plus a beer to take the edge off. I'd estimate that at least 60% of this job was dealing with logistics, and I even had a helper back in New York who would research hotels and flights for me. Every country is different, with different currencies and different languages, a different pace, and a different cultural customs. An unreserved train ticket means one thing in India and another in Spain. Had I done cursory research on the dual island African nation of Sao Tome and Principe, I would have known to show up with a wad of euros because the society is completely cash-based and there are no ATMs foreigners can use. At first, I tried traveling conventions that had worked for me on one-off trips, booking the planes and hotels in advance, picking the absolute cheapest fares, guarding against delays by taking 6 a.m. flights, which are the least likely to be canceled, then 4 6 a.m. flights in a row with the necessary 3 a.m. wake-up calls turned me into a zombie. I started listening to my rhythms. I am a night owl, for one, happy to wake up for sunrises, but usually not for planes. Inflexible travel plans give me anxiety, particularly when they were coupled with work deadlines. The trip had been planned to go from west to east, minimizing jet lag, but some time zones changes knocked me out. The 24-hour travel day from Zambia to Darwin, Australia, knocked me out for days. I've become far calmer from having to deal with mishap after mishap and realizing that nothing dire usually happens. There would be another plane and more trains if I'd missed that one, too. Maybe I'd lose a day, but when you're on the road this long, time becomes malleable, too. Lesson number 3, develop your superpower. So what countries are you going to? Asked Tina Phillips, a nurse at Passport Health in Orlando, Florida, which issues vaccinations and prescriptions for travelers who might encounter infectious diseases like malaria, rabies, or Japanese encephalitis. I started listing off my 52 places destinations. Miss Phillips typed the country's names into the computer, her eyes widening as she laughed at the absurdity. She sent me home with several needle sticks in my arm, $1,100 in preventive medicine, a video message telling my mother not to worry, and a spiral-bound printout of all my health vulnerabilities. One of my biggest fears going into this project was getting sick or injured and having to come home early, or worse, having something happen while I was in a remote location without access to adequate medical care. Getting sick is painful and often gross, but what worried me more was the potential time stuck on a trip so tightly scheduled that it would go off the rails if I spent days groaning on a hotel bathroom floor. My waistline was expanded, or rather has expanded, and diminished throughout this trip, but the medical kilts I built so meticulously before I left the U.S. have remained largely untouched in my suitcase. It's a stash so extensive that a customs officer at the ferry entrance to Tangier, Morocco, spent an hour threatening in Arabic to confiscate it and accusing me of being a drug dealer. Instead, I discovered I have a superpower, which may be the sole reason I've stayed relatively healthy. The ability to sleep anywhere under any conditions. Give me a window seat on an airplane, and it'll be lights out before takeoff. No earplugs, eye mask, or neck pillow. I'd fall asleep in hotels and noisy streets as dogs barked all night and in 20-minute chunks regulated by an alarm between writing paragraphs of articles on an all-nighter. In Tangier, two friends who joined me started looking like death because of hour-long prayer calls outside our windows every morning at 4 a.m. I didn't even notice them. But the only times I've gotten really sick were the colds I caught in Seville, Spain, and Chandigarh after extensive sleep deprivation. I warded them off with a lot of naps. Lesson number 4, try it. The rain in Chile and Patagonia never really seemed to stop. Every article of clothing I owned was soaked. Soppy socks, soppy shoes. The weather matched my mood. Earlier that week, I'd called my friends crying yet again, and I told her I wanted to quit. I was so far behind in writing, it felt like I was drowning in obligations I couldn't meet. What do people do when it rains like this? I asked the hotel manager in the National Park, Parque Pumalin, What do we do what we always do, he said. If we stopped for rain, nothing would ever get done. So in a small break in the rain, I went out to do what I always do, take pictures, talk to people, get to know the place. I was in the tiny town of Chaiten, which had been leveled by a volcanic eruption 10 years earlier. Residents had come back, but the buildings closest to the slope were still abandoned. I went to examine the ghost town. A few friendly construction workers were rebuilding a house, a school. I wandered further into an industrial building that had been overtaken by jungle growth straight out of Jurassic Park. The rain started up again while I was inside, exploring the concrete corridors and coming to the realization that I was inside an abandoned prison. And now I was trapped by torrential rain. For 2 hours, I watched the rain flood the dirt streets before me and the inside of this prison. I tweeted out my location just in case. Then my phone's battery died, and it was just me in the torrent, alone in the wilds of Patagonia with the sun going down. I had to make a decision, and the decision was to run through the rain, and that in that rain, soaked and running, I looked around at the blue-tinged mountains around me and the jungle shrubs on all sides and the kind people laughing at this silly foreigner who'd gotten caught in an abandoned prison in the rain, and realized that all the rest was superfluous. This was why I was here. Something crystallized for me in that moment of how singular this trip was. I started trying things. I jumped off a 30-foot cliff into a freezing river water while canyoning in Megeves, France, and scuba dived and surfed for the first time in Fiji. And maybe the scariest of all, tried a taco with a crispy fried ant in Gustu in La Paz, Bolivia. 2 days ago, my friend Ben saw a dish on the menu of a barbecue joint in Phnom Penh, Cambodia. He thought I should try to commemorate making it my 52nd place. Come on, he said. After this, you can tell everyone you tried fried spicy cow penis. The whole table agreed to join me. We ordered it, and the kitchen brought out fried spicy beef instead. We changed it for you, they said cheerily. Awesome, said Ben. We also want this one. The dish came out. It looked exactly as you would imagine. Ben ate a piece, then it was my turn. We have video evidence. I know I said try it, but you don't need to try that one. I did it for you. You're welcome. Lesson number 5. Learn what safe means to you. Iridice Dixon, 22, Melbourne, Australia, June 13th. Molly Tibbetts, 20, Brooklyn, Iowa, July 18th. Wendy Carina Martinez, 35, Washington, D.C., September 18th. Carla Stefaniak, 36, San Jose, Costa Rica, November 28th. Grace Milan, 22, Auckland, New Zealand, December 1st. Marwan Ulan, 28, and Luisa Vestalaga Jesperson, 24, Emil Morocco, December 21st. These are the names, ages, places, and dates of death of 7 women who were violently murdered while walking home, jogging, hiking, or taking a birthday trip in 2018. All of the news that has filtered across my phone screen while I've been bouncing around the world, none had the potential to throw me into a paralytic spiral more than reading about a woman killed simply because she was alone. Was there ever a time you felt unsafe? A friend asked me recently. The answer was no, not like I've been in the past when I escaped attackers in my Williamsburg, Brooklyn neighborhood or on a trip to France, and also always. Caution as a solo female traveler is healthy. Blind fear is not. I find that for me the best system is to always remember that I am a tourist. It's good to know what people who live in a place have to say about safety, but also realize that the rules that apply to them, who know where they're going and can blend in, don't apply to me. I've had to sacrifice areas of coverage I might otherwise enjoy, like nightlife, because I didn't feel safe going out alone. For the one destination that was all about going out in Belgrade, Serbia, I hired a translator guide to keep me company, who became a fast friend. In Bogota, I met a young female professor through Instagram who took me out with her friends for a night. There's a literal extra cost to being a woman traveling on your own. In cities where safety seemed like it might be an issue, I took cabs and Ubers rather than cheaper public transport. Climbing up certain mountains or going around certain cities, I opted for a guide and often paid extra because most private tours have a two-person minimum. At one point, I got delayed arriving at an Airbnb I'd booked in Glasgow and had to retrieve the key after midnight from a lockbox attached to a fence on a dark side street. A man, clearly on something, swayed back and forth about 20 feet away as I fumbled with the combination while also trying to keep an eye on my bags. When I got inside, the apartment was lovely, but the building looked like it had been through a bombing and never recovered. Certain landings, including mine, had no lights, and glass covered the floor from broken windows. I was hanging out with a local travel writer who usually walked me home at night, but if he hadn't been there, no one would have known my whereabouts. After that, I vowed to stay only in hotels with 24-hour front desk rather than rental apartments. The idea of dating in a strange land quickly went out the window. I didn't have time, and it didn't seem safe. But I didn't swear off romantic leanings entirely. All told, I had 4 make-out sessions all year, all in public or under what I felt like were very safe circumstances. Those seem like little miracles. Lesson number 6, still, talk to strangers. Oh, the stories of strangers that I could tell. In Montgomery, there was Marcus, an Uber driver who'd grown up in what he described as abject poverty, who gave me an inspired lecture on his city's complicated racial history. We picked up his neighbor, a nurse from work, as he does every night, and finished with a feast at Applebee's. In Puerto Rico, there was Blandine, a travel agent who greeted me dancing and singing by the baggage carousel a few months after Hurricane Maria, when much of the country was without power. A farmer, Elmer Sanchez, mentioned a party to me and my friend, and we showed up to find at least 400 people dancing to the best musicians in the country playing by the light of a generator. In Ypres, Belgium, there was the countless people attending the last post-ceremony to honor the missing fallen Commonwealth soldiers of World War I, who told me the stories of their valiant dead relatives and ripped my heart in two. In Matera, Italy, there was Cosimo Angelica, Maria Angela, Alessandro, and Marcello, who introduced me to possibly the world's most delicious food, Panzerotto, fried dough with cheese and tomato sauce, and made me feel like I was family, even with my rusty Italian. In Kigali, Rwanda, there was an M.A., now a surrogate sister, and I, her entire family, who hosted me at a birthday gathering 2 days after I met them, while also sharing their stories of surviving genocide. What's the biggest lesson you've learned is a question I often get. I always answer that people are fundamentally good around the world. Lesson number 7, alone does not mean lonely. Solo travel is an experience that I'd urge every human, and particularly every woman, to try at least once. You'll find that while you might physically be without people you know, you're rarely alone. I had a device in my pocket that allowed me to call home and to post a picture on an app that opened up conversations with strangers who just seemed to want to wish me well. While in Patagonia, I spent 4 hours climbing a volcano in the rain by myself to reach a desolate summit with nothing but burned trees and ashen pebbles. Out of the freezing cold mist came a hooded figure. "Hable español inglés?" I asked. "English," he told me. He was a vegan punk rock drummer from Berlin who liked to laugh a lot and pet stray dogs, and we ended up traveling together for the next 5 days. My parents were rocks through the ups and downs. Weekly phone calls with my therapist were among the best work I did. Certain friends became lifelines. There was Heidi Vogt with her endless logistical know-how, Jean Lee, an expert on Korea, and also on how to pack for any eventuality, Chihuahua Shao, a poet friend who kept me clear-headed on writing, Marie Turns, who talked me through story ideas even 2 days before having her first child. For the past week, I've stayed put in my 52nd place, the small town of Kep on the Cambodian coast. The plan was to spend the holidays alone in this tranquil piece of heaven, on the beach, banging out my final articles. Then I got an Instagram DM from an acquaintance from Los Angeles. She had seen a photo I'd posted from Kep, and it was a strange coincidence, but she and a girlfriend would be there the next day. Then I got another message from Ben, who lives in Bangkok. He and his girlfriend Zoe were trying to figure out at least one vacation to take before they moved to New York. Would I recommend Kep? Within 10 minutes, he sent me his hotel booking and flight information. The next morning, I befriended a British family at my hotel, and we got along so well, we went on a sunset cruise together. The posse grew with each new arrival. We'd feast on crabs, then head to a bar to play cards until the owner kicked us out. It was a magical holiday, and in it, I could see glimpses of the future of being surrounded by found family, content in each other's company, of traveling solo, but never being or desiring to be truly alone. What's next? I don't know. I might be physically going back to the apartment I left behind in Brooklyn 12 months ago, but the center of my life isn't there for me anymore. It's with me, and it's mobile. Wow. What a travel itinerary she had, right? And quite a challenge. Well, if you follow the news, you probably hear a lot about hot spots. Well, travel writer Lena Workhays has come up with a list of destinations that really are hot spots. And this list was published in the January 27, 2019 issue of the News and Observer, and we're going to read some of them for you in our remaining few minutes. For an update on ash, lava, steam, smoke, visit a volcano. These five destinations provide a multifaceted opportunity to get outside and learn more about planet Earth, she writes. First choice is Mount Vesuvius, Italy. Located 16 miles southeast of Naples, Pompeii is a popular destination, one of the most visited archaeological sites on the planet. When Mount Vesuvius erupted in the year AD 79, the lava flow covered the flourishing Roman towns of Pompeii and Herculaneum, as well as the surrounding area. The ruins, accessible to the public since the mid-18th century and now a UNESCO World Heritage Site, tell a compelling story of what life was like during opulent times. Hikers can ascend to the top of the inactive volcano for a grand view of the landscape. To understand the history, walking tours and other guided opportunities are available. And there is information online, Lynn adds, and that is at PompeiiSites.org/EN. Pompeii, P-O-M-P-E-I-I. PompeiiSites.org/EN. Next is Arenal Conservatory Lodge, Costa Rica, and that's spelled A-R-E-N-A-L. Wake to a chorus of tropical wildlife in the only lodge located inside the Arenal Volcano National Park on this volcanic wonder. The majestic and perfectly shaped centerpiece of a rich rainforest setting can be observed from most guest rooms, the dining room, and an expansive deck. Horseback riding, biking, and hiking trails wind through old lava fields and soft jungle trails where howling monkeys, slithering snakes, butterflies, and colorful birds beckon visitors. The lodge serves a great base camp from which to access river rafting, zip lines, hanging bridges, and hot springs. The last eruption of Arenal took place in 2010. Austin Lehman Adventures offers family tours to the region. Online, check it out at austinlehman.com. Lehman is spelled L-E-H-M-A-N, austinlehman.com. Also, arenalobservatorylodge.com. Arenal again, A-R-E-N-A-L, arenalobservatorylodge.com. Then there's Mount St. Helens, Washington. On March 20, 1980, an earthquake of 4.2 magnitude reawakened the volcano, leading to the May 18th collapse and eruption. Today, families visiting the National Volcano Monument, about 50 miles northeast of Portland, can learn more about the geologic and biologic history of the volcanic peaks that dominate the Cascade Range through interpretive talks, walks, and theater presentations. Hiking, biking, and helicopter tours also provide expansive views. So there you go. It's quite a journey today, and we'll have more in our next episode. Hope you've enjoyed your travels today. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.